Dorkness to Light, hosted by Alan and M. Middleton.
We aim to explore what takes place at the corner of theology and geekology.
Episode 38, Reviews, Recos, and a Rant.
Welcome to episode 38 of Dorkness to Light. This is our show where we take a look at pop culture in terms of where those stories intersect with concepts in religion, faith, theology, and spirituality.
In this episode, we don't have a single topic, but we'll be talking about a handful of things we've experienced recently and wanted to share with y'all. And yes, Becky Smith from Redeemed Otaku, I did steal the word recos from you, short for recommendations.
Because it's adorable.
So, I'm going to start with a book review. A free book that I got somehow, possibly from the in-laws when they moved. There were a couple other people who were giving away free books last year. And I've talked about my fascination with books about the millennial.
The millennials.
And so when I saw this one about the turn of the first millennium, I knew I had to give it a read. And this is AD 999.
I am already here because it feels like it should be a cyberpunk title. But with monks, like actual monks,
yeah,
not
exactly.
Future space monks.
This is by Jadriel Bell, and it was a side project of an author who's written a lot of urban fantasy, and this was the work that she did under a pen name. And this is the only work under this name, but it is an author whose name I did not recognize, but had written dozens of urban fantasy books. And this is from the back of the book, calls this an apocalyptic novel that weaves together the myths, legends, and prophecies of the Celts, the Norse, and the Christians, set in AD 999. And in this case, what you have is Satan, instead of looking ahead to Megiddo and Armageddon, says, you know, maybe I can bring the end of the world a little bit early. Take advantage of this turn of the millennium. So he's bringing about the end of the world in England. And in order to bring his plans to fruition, Satan allies himself with Loki and the Unseelie Court of the Fae.
Perfect. Excellent. Wonderful. Magnificent.
These forces of evil, of course, have to be opposed by the two witnesses from the Book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, one is Alwyn, a crippled monk, and the other is Kenig, a pagan witch.
So excellent!
We have villains on all sides of spirituality and religion. We have heroes and heroines on all sides of that. And they learn to live together and be respectful of each other's different beliefs. They don't fall in love and get married and become a mixed interfaith melding of their faiths or something. They stay who they are.
Don't need no Romo.
With respect and with admiration, and their peoples learn to trust and work with each other. I'm not saying it's a great novel. I'm saying it's pretty much the perfect Dorkness novel. That's all I'm saying.
Remember, folks, there is a difference between good
and awesome.
And awesome. And this sounds awesome.
It had everything. It had everything. I did want to talk a little bit about some crowdfunded.
Oh yeah, and some
things
freebies
that we've been receiving recently.
So, our old favorite prototypical Dorkness band, Mara in the Mainsail, recently renamed itself to Coyote Kid with the release of the band's third album, Skeleton Man, which is excellent.
Yeah.
I will say, for people who did not like Thaumatrope because it was too dark and obsessed with death,
stay away.
This particular album is the story of the zombie apocalypse told from the perspective of a condemned man who becomes the new Grim Reaper in the penultimate song. So, they changed their name. They did not change their deep, weirdly erotic relationship with death.
They are fully going for goth tent headlining at this year's Audio Feed.
Absolutely.
Off of the other stage. We want to dominate the goth tent. That is what they're going for.
100%. I joke a little bit, but literally the last song on the album, which is also called Skeleton Man, mm-hmm. is literally written like a love song. In the instrumentation, it is a very mm-hmm. soft, almost acoustic sort of sweet, I don't know if this is going to work out for us, but I want to make an effort, take it slow. You don't have to change for me, I'll change for you. But again, singing to the embodiment of death. So like, the band name has changed, but it still is what it is.
Then, if you want slightly different style of music, a little more singer-songwriter, we've got a new EP from Formerly Bodies, which is a one-person band, Hannah. Her EP is Daydreamer.
And excellent.
You saw her play last summer.
Yeah, she was
probably testing out some of those.
Yeah,
some of
playing
those songs.
Locally with some of her new songs that had not yet gone to the album yet. This one's another sort of little bit of a mismatch. So you're like, oh, mm-hmm. a lady singer-songwriter. She looks like a very sort of stereotypical
right.
kind of country girl, you know, plays guitar, writes music.
But there's some edge to
there's
it.
There's some pretty serious edge. She gets very real. Mm. When she performed live, she had a pretty long soliloquy about mental health, which was really, really, really moving and which tied in to a lot of the themes in this album, Daydreamer.
We mentioned the modern worship performer, Jeff Anderson.
Of Anderson Kale. Most notable for being half of our yes. theme song performer.
Recently received his new album, All Things New. Very good, if that's the style of music that you like. And I had one to mention that was not music-related, but comic-related. And I don't want to talk too much about it, because it's a potential Dorkness to Light episode.
Oh, for sure.
And that is, I've just gotten the PDFs. But the full printed version is probably a month away. And that is Meredith Finch, a legitimate longtime comics professional, sometimes working with her husband David Finch, sometimes as a solo creator in mainstream comics. But she kickstarted and funded an original graphic novel, modern retelling, 20th century retelling of the Book of Ruth. And my impression is it's Depression era. I want to say a little Grapes of Wrath meets the Book of Ruth was my impression of it. It just looked so cool. The art looked cool. The story looked cool. This is one of the things that crowdfunding can do. Like, this is sort of one of her dream projects that is just, no matter how good her career is going, DC, Marvel, Image, nobody's going to pick it up.
Yeah, who are you going to pitch this to? Who's going to publish it? Like a really small Christian press? I mean, maybe, but they're not going to have
what's
the sort of financials.
What's distribution? What finances? This is where the crowdfunding, Mar and the Mainsail, Coyote Kid, Comrade, some of these other acts on the music side, but also in terms of other creatives, this gives a place for a person who, in case of Meredith Finch, does not do Christian comics, does regular mainstream comics, but based on her faith, wanted to tell this particular story, and going the independent crowdfunded route was a way that makes sense, was a way that was viable, and was a way that was successful. So I've just skimmed the first few pages. Very excited when we got it. And like we said, it's one that we will get back to at some point, I imagine.
And speaking of comics, we've mentioned this artist a couple of times on my Tumblr, because I share her art quite frequently because it's incredible. But there is a person on Tumblr doing illustrations. Her username is tomato-bird. And she does incredible biblically inspired eldritch angels and things of that nature. But she also does a lot of very moving biblically inspired short comics. So she did one which I know I've shared called 30 Years, which is about Jesus and Mary's relationship in the weeks and months before he leaves for his
to begin his ministry.
And it basically, the key center of that is a dinner that he's having with his parents before he leaves, where Mary sort of realizes, wait a minute. This is when things are going to start. Things are going to start, and then things are going to go really bad. And the two of them are sort of having a conversation while Joseph is there, but the two of them are sort of having a different conversation, playing off of the various prophecies and revelations that Mary has received, and her sort of trying to cope with those.
The sword will pierce her side too.
Yes, while also like seeing her son right in front of her and him saying, no, but I need to go, and her trying to comfort him as he comforts her. It's great stuff. She really does a great job of digging into the tragedy and the drama of the biblical stories, which especially for people who grew up in the church, we really do just gloss over a lot of the tragedy because it's like, oh yeah, you know, you've just always known that's how it ends.
But they didn't.
And it's like really, it's really powerful, messed up, really sad stuff. The most recent of these that she released is now available as a PDF, which can be purchased in bundles with her other books through her website, which is also tomato-bird.com. If you search that name, you'll find her for sure. And that comic is called The Wanderer.
Ah.
And it is amazing. It is about a little piece of theology, sort of minor biblical event that a lot of people either skim over or kind of ignore or don't really get, that she really drills down into in a really beautiful and tragic way, which is the harrowing of hell. And Jesus died and went to hell and ascended. That process of Jesus going to hell is the comic. And it is told from the perspective of the angel of death, who in this comic interpretation is the messenger who was sent to Cain after he killed Abel. That she was the first one to bear witness to a murder. And as a result, her role throughout human history has been to gather the souls of those that have been murdered and abandoned and lost. And she is sort of the keeper of all of the souls of the damned. It plays really well on the sort of more existential horror of hell, that it's not like the fiery pits.
Right.
It's based much more in Sheol, the Hebrew idea of death,
the grave, the separation,
the darkness, the pit, the void. I'm going to give away the twist right now because it's genius. But when you first see there is a sundered soul, at least for me, maybe not for other people, maybe other people were smarter, I assumed it was Judas. It is not Judas. It's Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't find this out until you find Judas in hell, impaled on a cross of thorns. And the way that hell is harrowed is actually by Jesus crawling up onto the cross next to Judas and saying, I forgive you.
Right.
And in that moment, that is the light enters through the wound. The wound is where the light enters, is sort of a moment that in that moment that he returns the kiss of betrayal, but as a kiss of forgiveness. And in that moment is like the breaking of the shackles, the freeing of the souls. The debt is being paid.
Right.
No one has to pay for this. And the angel is sort of standing back and is saying, but this isn't right. This is what they deserve. And then in the finale, she is also then freed of her own shackles and is back on earth and is like, okay, well, now what do I do? And she hears a voice behind her that says, I'm sorry. We are looking for the teacher. Where is his body? And she's the one who then gets to turn around and say, he is not here.
Ah.
And I'm like,
boom.
Dope. great commentary on ethics, on theology, on like the nature of forgiveness, really digging into the human drama and the human trauma, digging into original sin in a way that really makes sense. In this interpretation, original sin very much feels like a stain or an illness.
Right.
It's a thing that can infect you. And in this case, actually manages to infect an angel.
Mm.
That the angel is in and of herself caught up in this whole system of debts and payments.
Wow.
And that Jesus is able to bring that restoration to her too. Like, it's genius. Let me just say, all of Tomato Bird's stuff is all biblically based, but definitely comes from a perspective of, I'm going to make a really good story that makes use of theology, but isn't bounded by, like, really strict theology. And it lets her do really, really interesting stuff.
And it's, what was this one called?
This is called The Wanderer. Excellent, excellent, excellent.
Let me do a quick podcast. Recco. And that is a new show called The Way of the Fathers. And this is part of the Catholic Culture podcast family. And the host is Mike Aquilina. And this is someone who actually we followed about 8 or 10 years ago when we were just getting started with podcasting. He would show up on other shows. And his specialty is the early church and the church fathers. So he was that guy.
Ah, that guy.
And that's what this show is. It's basically weekly episodes, or maybe 8 or 10 of them out now. Very easy to catch up on, 10, 15 minutes each, about, at this point, just the church fathers, though he promises church mothers and other aspects of the early church are coming. And it's intended to be sort of a narrative history podcast in the history of Rome vibe, where it just sort of goes chronological, and each episode focuses on one patriarch or church leader or church concept. And again, we're pretty in the early 100s. We've gotten to Justin Martyr and obviously Polycarp very early on and some of those early folks of the church we haven't gotten. We've gotten to the letter of St. Clement. I mean, we are very early.
Pre-Augustine.
So easy. Well before. So very easy to get caught up on. And again, it's really what this guy has been doing for decades in a very concise, manageable, easy to understand layman's type of perspective. So that's The Way of the Fathers.
Okay. I'm actually going to give a kind of weird non sequitur of a recommendation. But there is a podcast that I have recently found. It is associated very 2 to 3 layers removed from the whole McElroy family, Max Fun empire. And it is a show called Neat, that's NEAT exclamation point, The Booze Cast. And it is a history of alcohol and drinking culture and things like that, which you would think...
Just to clarify, you have been going to Episcopal Church recently. Huh, interesting.
Weird.
Wow. Huh.
You would think, like, how much religious content is going to be on a podcast about drinking, a surprising amount, because thus far they've done
go monks.
Yeah, 3 or 4 episodes that have largely featured monks. There was an entire episode about Hildegard von Bingen, patron saint of hops. There was a whole episode about monk brewing. There have been several other episodes where monks and Hildegard featured pretty prominently. There was a whole episode on Prohibition, which they've done. It's Prohibition, the 1970s cocktail revival, and monk brewing are like their big 3 historical touchstones. Like, they're going to hit one of the 3 basically every single episode. And they talked at one point about priest fraud and synagogue fraud, because for sacramental reasons, you could still make, distribute, and consume alcohol during Prohibition. So at one point, the number of churches in a particular city tripled and the number of synagogues quadrupled. As far as, you know, how do I get this amount of wine and who takes it and which buildings and where can it be served? And they talked about that for a while. And I was like, that is fascinating. That is a thing I never would have thought of.
A little loose with their standards of who qualified for.
They did a whole thing about, like, and then how did that get cracked down on, and who got cracked down, and
That is, in fact, perfect dorkness content. Because this, the religious stuff is all over the place, if you have eyes to see it.
Oh.
Or in this case, ears to hear the podcast.
That's what's so perfect about podcasting, is even if it's not something you're interested in, if we have learned nothing else, people like listening to other people talk about things that they know a lot about or are very passionate about.
I've got another podcast recommendation, the Kaiju Apostle podcast.
Okay, so I'm not going to have the weirdest recommendations on this episode. That is really good to know.
Two seminarians, so, you know, trouble.
Absolute troublemakers.
Diving into the Toho monster films to see what's lying beneath the surface.
I love that.
And the religious, ethical, social content is actually pretty minimal. It's mostly fanboys.
Perfect.
But where appropriate, they certainly will dig into dorkness-tinged content, and obviously a lot of those monster movies, they do tend to have something to say. There is a theme of some kind, whether it's pacifism or whatever it is.
Dangers of nuclear war, or
environmental this, or social that. Actually, even the bad ones do tend to try to say something, and these two fellas try to ferret that out. Again, that's a show that's got about 10 or 12 episodes out there now, so easily catch up-able, if so desired.
Excellent. This is a good chance that I can talk about my Werner Herzog documentary, which I have also been info dumping about to basically everyone I meet for a month and a half now.
At this point, you can just direct them to this episode now.
Yes! Why would I want to do that when I can instead talk about Paleolithic cave paintings?
Yes.
So this is about the Werner Herzog documentary, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, which is about the Lisieux, I believe is how it's pronounced, cave structures in France, which were discovered in the early 2000s after a rock slide opened up this small chasm, and some spelunkers went investigating in there and discovered the oldest preserved cave paintings in the world. The previous record was about 15 to 18,000 years old. These ones are 33,000 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. 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 The paintings themselves are gorgeous. I learned about them in college that I took an art history class, right, and I had a choice.
Ancient or modern?
Yeah, it was ancient or modern. It was everything after 1700 or everything before 1700. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'll go with the pre-1700. Great choice. Did get to look at a lot of really, really, really cool cave paintings.
Yeah.
But they're very famous paintings. And Werner Herzog did a documentary where he and a very small group of people were able to go and see the paintings in person. And then they also spoke with a lot of experts, because the cave exploration team is a very interesting sort of scientific venture in that it is a multidiscipline team.
Mm-hmm.
So there are, of course, you know, paleontologists and geologists and art historians and, you know, people who will do carbon dating and analysis and all these sorts of things. But there are also actually a lot of artists that are involved. So it's not just scientists. It's not just historians.
Interesting.
Because one of the big processes that they are working on is actually digitizing the cave.
Ah, right.
Because the problem is that the cave is so delicate that even people going in and breathing will raise the pH in the air. It will raise the carbon dioxide content. Mm-hmm. It'll raise the temperature. It'll raise the humidity. And the paintings will actually start to mold because they've been kept in this pristine state because of a cave-in. And now there's just this little teeny tiny gap. So what they're trying to do is get in and get as much information as possible before there's any sort of deterioration, and then preserve it for as long as possible, and then use those images in order to do most of their research off of, so that they can leave the site as undisturbed as possible and preserve it as long as possible. And they talk pretty frequently about the way that you feel this sense of presence.
Mm.
And an extremely cool thing about the documentary that it manages to do basically right at the end is as you're going through the documentary, you're meeting all of these people, and it almost goes from most to least technical. Like, the later you get right. in the documentary, you get more of the historians, more of the, like, writers, more of the artists. And at the very end, you meet one of the last members of the team who is a professor of religion.
Mm.
And this documentary manages to do something that I'm, like, really passionate about, which is doing right by early religions,
mm-hmm.
like what people right. will generally call the primitive religions, mm-hmm. you know, early animism and shamanism. People get really, really, like, rude and dismissive of those sorts of practices, and a lot of times like to forget that those practices still endure today mm-hmm. in certain areas and deserve to be absolutely as respected as any other religious tradition. And there's a really cool part where they're talking about the painting and the repainting and preservation, and they're saying that the most analogous thing that we have to these paintings is actually in Aboriginal Australia, where there are also paintings that are not quite as old, but that get repainted frequently.
Right.
So that they stay. And the stories that go along with them, that the oral tradition and the physical art tradition is one and the same with the religion, that the practice of the religion is the preservation of the history. There was a really interesting story that one of the scientists told, that he saw one of the Aboriginal elders who was repainting an area, and he said something like, well, what are you doing? What are you painting? And the elder said, I don't know. I am not the artist. I am the hand.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, mm-hmm. oh, okay. So there's all this sort of stuff going on about, like, this sort of, like, commentary on the way that history moves through us and having a living, fluid relationship with our own history. And the religion and theology and philosophy professor at the end has, like, some really interesting stuff that he says about this early type of religion, which is really insightful without being super dismissive, and talks about the way that the religion functions is about, like, portals and transformation, about doors that can talk and people that become animals and objects that are concepts and all sorts of things like that, and the way those things aren't permanent and they're fluid and they move, and that's reflected in their art, and just all these beautiful things. And right at the end, he sort of puts it all together in this one little crystalline statement. He says, you know, and I think about us, Homo sapien. I'm not sure I really agree with that, you know, man who knows. We don't know anything. I'm a bigger fan of Homo spiritualists.
Mm.
Those who believe. That is our species. That is our legacy. Wow. It's that we believe. And I was like, ugh! It was a fantastic documentary. I highly recommend it for many reasons, not least Werner Herzog's weird obsession with one of the digital artists who says, well, you know, I used to grow up in the circus. And then Werner Herzog proceeds to interrogate him about his circus experience
for like a mini documentary
in the middle of this thing. But there's a lot of very, very good stuff about the relationship to nature and religion and the roots of religion and the roots of spirituality and what it means for us as a species to believe in things. It's fantastic.
This is not exactly the same, but what I thought of was one of our favorite saints, Saint Kateri Tikakwitha, who was a Native American of the Algonquin and Mohawk region, ended up converting to Catholicism and becoming a saint. One of the first Native-born American saints, or as a designation, an important American saint, North American saint. And one of her legacies, I guess, is the Saint Kateri Conservation Center, I believe it's called. And it is a very nature-based environmentalist Catholic organization. And I think it is sort of blending some of these native priorities,
mm-hmm.
you know, honoring her history and her legacy. And so they set up bird sanctuaries and butterfly gardens across the country in Catholic schools and Catholic parishes. And I think it's important just to, as like that recognition. And it's not that we're, you know, syncretic, you know, pulling these things and blending into a faith, into, you know, one blended faith that everything's a part of, but that even in a context of a Christian Catholic faith, you can learn from, mm-hmm. incorporate.
Make room for
some of these other practices, or what those other practices were speaking to, were teaching to.
Yeah,
it's not exactly the same, but when you were talking about, obviously you talk about native religion, I always think of St. Kateri.
Always think of St. Kateri. We love St. Kateri.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, to take both of those, of some native sort of elements of culture and things, and talking about early proto-religion, I want to talk about some video games. So I have been playing a lot of a game called Horizon Zero Dawn.
You and I have discussed how to try to get video game content on the show. We're going to try to pick up on some of these again. So
this one's going to be its own episode.
Maybe
don't worry.
Like Book of Ruth, this might be a preview for a longer episode at some point.
Because
so.
Let me just say, I actually realized something that you may have realized last time I was telling you about this, but I didn't realize I realized until I was talking with Mom about it.
Oh my.
There's like five or six like different discrete religious and spiritual and in some cases biblical, in some cases apocalyptic. Like there's a lot of layers going on this thing.
And this is Zero Horizon Dawn.
Horizon Zero Dawn.
To be fair, I got most of the words right.
In approximately the correct order. It is hilarious that this has become its own genre now, but the semi-post-apocalyptic, techno-inspired fighting dinosaur games. Ark Survival Unleashed or
right.
something like okay. that was the first one. Horizon Zero Dawn is better in literally every way. Played a lot of Ark because it was the only thing that sort of scratched
right.
this itch a little bit. And then Horizon Zero Dawn came along with really complex characters, incredibly nuanced writing, really strong storytelling, beautiful graphics, incredible. Like, I could talk about the mechanics of this game, about how the mechanics of your actual ability to fight and relate to the environment is actually very reflective of sort of Native American sort of inspired ethics when it comes to the environment, the way that you can relate to the animals and the machines and the people that you interact with. Like, it's all part of a fluid ecosystem, which you are also a part of, and you can choose the way that you relate to them in order to actually meet your goals. There's no requirement of you have to kill and scavenge. There's no requirement of you have to tame and adapt. It's brilliant.
So
it's
what's
brilliant
the,
and
what's
it's
the,
genius.
What's the concept of the game? And hit us with one or two of these cool elements.
All right. Quick summary. We are in post-apocalyptic Earth. A old, rusted shell of the old civilizations of Earth remains. But humanity lives on now in small tribal enclaves throughout what we discover is the Four Corners region. It is so cool. Someone took a map of the game with its topography, because topography is a pretty big
right.
part of this game, of finding ways to climb certain mountains or getting to certain levels or crossing certain passes.
And it's accurate to
they
that
mapped it to
region.
Colorado.
Amazing.
The area where you begin is in a tribe called the Nora, which is very much based on a sort of Native American inspired sort of structure as far as what does the society look like? What do the clothes look like? What is the general sort of division of labor? And it takes a lot of those sort of native elements, but manages to do it in a very respectful and reasonable way.
Right.
The game is great about having lots of different cultures and social hierarchies and religions, and having them all interact in ways that make sense for individual characters. In the post-apocalyptic Earth, the way that people relate to the technology that survives and the like little bits and pieces of American culture that have survived this apocalypse is based on all sorts of different factors, environmental factors and social factors and all sorts of stuff. And each one of the societies really makes sense. So there is the matriarchal society of the Nora, which lives up in mountains and is all about sort of seclusion and sequestering and preserving their own way of life, but isn't really interested in reaching out to other societies. Then there is another large tribe, which is sort of in prior years had really been building towards becoming an empire, largely based on war and conquest and on capturing the other tribes around them. And a lot of that was done through use of religious pageantry, having their primary deity being a sun god. And the way that they related the sun god to the way that they were going to expand and control has to do a lot with the way that their politics work. Whereas with the Nora, it's matriarchal, but they do a really good job of not being like, well, here's the bad patriarchy, which is evil, and here's the good matriarchy, which is pure. Because there is still a hierarchy and a society, and there are ways that that system can still be abused. Your main character that you play as is an outcast from the Nora. And so the way that she relates to her own society is actually strained because she is not allowed to participate in it.
Oh.
So she comes from that culture. She has that understanding, but she doesn't have those social ties. So when she leaves the game, the way that she thinks about herself changes a lot, because as soon as she leaves the sacred lands, everyone goes, ah, the Nora. And she says, I have never been a Nora in my whole life. I was abandoned as a child. And because she doesn't have a mother, she doesn't have a place in the tribe.
Right.
Motherhood is everything.
Right.
They have their great mother is centered in their sacred mountain. Their sacred mountain has one of the bunkers of the old world. And as a result, the way that they have conceptualized their great mother is based on their relationship with this old technology. And the way they understand this old technology is through their religious and social lens. There's lots of stuff about like personhood and identity and purpose and prophecy and all sorts of stuff. What is destiny? Predestination versus free will. Like it gets crazy, it gets deep, it gets intense. It manages to pull on constructed religions that make sense as their own systems in the current world, where you can definitely see, oh, this religion is drawn from the Aztecs, but it definitely has some hints of Catholicism for sure. But the way those blend are not the way that Latin American Catholicism exists now. Or say, oh, well, this one's very Inuit. But then the way that they talk about things actually also has some relations to Shinto or to African shamanism. It manages to blend all those elements in ways that make sense in the present. And then also separately through having physical records and archives and logs and things from the old world, is able to play on religion that exists now, specifically doing call outs to the Book of Exodus, you know, modern Protestant Christianity. It manages to touch on the Egyptian pantheon, the Greek pantheon. Like there's lots and lots and lots of religious shout outs, which in those cases make sense because they're the real world religions of that time.
Right.
And then there are separately call outs being made to the constructed religions that exist in world in the present, which also makes sense because those are the religions that exist in the present.
So what you're saying is all that money we spent getting you a college degree, majoring in sociology, anthropology, minoring in religion and ancient studies, finally paying off.
So,
boom!
So I can play this game.
Yes! It's all worth it. That sounds epic.
It's really good. Bob Fisher at one point was like, I bought a PS4. What should I be playing? I was like, Horizon, Zero, Dawn. I know there are other things that you could be playing, but seriously, if you have a PS4 and if you either have a library that has video games or $35 to drop on a used copy of Horizon Zero Dawn, you owe it to yourself. It is expansive like Skyrim, but it is very well structured. it manages to take a lot of stuff that I liked about Dragon Age Inquisition, but take it two or three steps further, really rooting things in the personal, rooting things in interpersonal relationships, like that whole thing with the big empire. There's a new emperor now because he killed his father. Because his father was an objectively terrible person. He has started his reign in bloodshed. He murdered his own father. How is he then going to make that worthwhile? Can he make enough social changes to make a fundamentally different empire that he can hand on to his descendants, where he's going to actively do right by the people that they have hurt? Like, that's a really good, complex, like, internal drama, and it's for a non-playable character that you meet for four quests for about an hour and a half of game time.
But it's thought out.
Literally, I cannot shout out enough to the team who made it on the visual side, because the actual graphics they do are so well realized. All of the characters are really well designed. Literally characters who are like merchants.
Right.
That you meet and they have three funny lines and then they're just a side quest. It's always delivered well. They feel meaningful. They have their own inner lives that are well thought out, well performed. It's like theater for a video game. There are no small roles. Like everyone is the hero of their own story. You really do buy it. Every person is on their own journey. They just occasionally intersect with Aloy. Also, there is a young priest who I very much love, because basically all the old priests were awful and evil. And there's a like 21-year-old priest who's now the new high priest and is kind of having a giant panic attack.
Good.
Because he's basically the highest ranked priest that was left after all the other priests got murdered or kicked out. And now he's like the Pope. And he's like, please help. I'm trying to be ecumenical and nice. But also, I don't know what any of these people believe. And I know they're really upset. And I know that me showing up and my big giant sun robes are not going to help anything. When the last time they saw people in giant sun robes,
their
families were being thrown to the literal robo wolves. Like, secondary thing, I also need to play the video game Journey, which is literally about the hero's journey.
So, sneak previews of potential upcoming episodes. So, so far, we've done some reviews, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We've done some recommendations.
Oh, yeah. Go play Horizon Zero Dawn.
So it's time for a rant.
Yes.
Or the closest thing that I do to a rant.
We did promise this back in the early days.
That we would occasionally have some rants.
Problem was, this is an episode of a TV show. And as I was watching it, I said, oh, I got to blog about this on the Darkness to Light page, which, you know, has not had a lot of blogging recently.
Look, it's been a long time.
Because it's no longer 2009. But still, and then I got to the end, and I do what I always do. Delete. Confirm. Oh, I don't have the... So I can't take a screen cap. So this is the blog post that would have been. And I'm talking about actually a pretty good episode of a pretty good new TV show based on a very good comic by excellent comic book writer Greg Rucka.
So this is no shade to any of those things.
Absolutely not. This is the show is Stumptown. It's a PI series that takes place in Portland, and by the way, has a great cast. Just throwing that out too. It's a pretty good show. But there was an episode recently that involved church-related things, and of course the bad guys were from the church. But that's not the rant.
No.
We're used to that.
Mm-hmm.
That happens.
I have actually said this not infrequently as playing Horizon Zero Dawn. When certain religious things come up, that Kara will turn and look at me and go like, huh, that does kind of sound like the Crusades and the Inquisition and the this and the that. And I'll just have to look at her and be like, I know where I stand. Look, Christianity has been the dominant religion on this planet for a really long time, or at the very least in this section of the hemisphere. It means that basically every bad thing that has happened, and every good thing, and basically every important thing has all been because of the... I know where I stand. I know. I know. Trust me. I know. We've done some stuff. We do some stuff.
But that's not the rant.
We're aware.
That's not
the rant. That's not the problem.
The rant, it begins with the establishing shot of the church. And it's the Holy Shepherd Church. And just off the top of my head, those are all religious words. I don't know that I've ever heard them put together before. There are lots of holy blank churches.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Holy Spirit, Holy Family, Holy Mother,
mm-hmm.
Holy Cross.
Or Good Shepherd.
Good Shepherd, Church of the Shepherd.
Mm-hmm,
lots
mm-hmm.
of those. But holy and shepherd, and that, oh, I think I might need to pay attention. It's possible they don't know what they're talking about.
That was the first yellow flag.
Then we get inside the church, and there's a big crucifix in it. And
now,
this has previously been described as a megachurch fallen on hard times, which implies evangelical. They may even said evangelical in it. Now, the presence of the big crucifix, I'll be honest, it gave an opportunity for a pretty good scene of our lead character, Dex, having a conversation with Jesus.
Yes.
That worked.
We know why they put it there.
If that was the only thing.
We know why it's there. It's there so that you can have a cool scene later, which is fine. But
it doesn't belong in an evangelical megachurch. And then the character goes back to the church later during a service. And we get this, quote, former megachurch. Look, we've been in megachurches. I still go to one.
Yeah.
We know what they look like. They look like office parks.
Yeah. They look like office parks, and they have, like, those big, kind of sterile amphitheaters that you go see self-help speakers in.
There are screens on the sides. There is a cross, hopefully. But not a crucifix. None of that. What we get when we walk into the service is something that looks like a small-town United Methodist church in the country. It's old wooden pews with hymns in the back of them and the pencils where you write down your envelope for the offering. And up on the side, you have those signs that have the tiles that you put the hymn numbers on. Yes, that's a church, but it's not what you described, and it's not what you were railing against big evangelical this, that, and the others. That was your big bogeyman. That's not what this is. This is grandma's little safe country church. We've got a episode about church stuff. Let's set dress it with church stuff. We know what church stuff is.
Do you?
You don't know what this church stuff is. That's the problem. That's the problem. So, know your stuff. Just know your stuff. That's all we're asking.
That's all we ask. All we ask is that John 48:17 doesn't show up on Fox Mulder's wall or whatever the heck.
Exactly. Exactly. Just know your stuff. Know that's all. That's all.
Know your stuff.
Rant over. Now we're back. Thank you, Hannah from Formerly Bodies, for providing us with that lovely kick-started transition music. Now, we have awesome listeners. And you, awesome listeners, regularly send us awesome feedback. So it's time to go through that entire bag of your emails, faxes, and notes. Nathaniel Wayne gave M a very kind shout-out on Twitter a while back, replying to someone who was looking for non-binary people to learn about and encourage followers to say nice things about non-binary people, Nathaniel said.
M. Middleton of the Dorkness Delight podcast is amazing. Oh. So smart, so expressive, so passionate.
Thanks.
Speaking of expressive and passionate, you want to talk about Zero Dawn third?
Don't worry. Don't worry.
Horizon Dawn.
I'm going to finish it. I've got about 6 hours left in the campaign. Next week, you'll get to sit here and listen to me for 3 hours. Yes. I'm giving you a break.
Yes, I will.
Bex from the Redeemed Otaku podcast also sent a couple messages this fall that we hadn't really had a chance to cover yet. She says, I just listened to episode 31. I love Stephen Lawhead and remember being thrilled to hear he was Christian. Also, I am totally interested in looking up that Anime Angels magazine that Em mentioned. Great episode.
One update we can give on that is that you found your physical copies. We've got about 6 or 8 of them.
They're sitting behind your chair.
They are right here.
Who knows? And, who knows what we're going to do with them?
At least I'm going to scan the covers, nothing else, for starters. And then, you know, if there's a good piece of art in there or something like that. I did check, and Lulu.com still exists as a site. I don't know if it's actively buying and selling things anymore, if it's been abandoned. I have no idea. That is where we found them from, Anime Angels.
She also wrote in about episode 33, where we talked about her making rice during a panel, and said, you guys are amazing. Thank you so much for the kind words. You described what I do at Ramen Con so much better than I could. And on episode 35, with guest Chris Tyler, she says, the hubby loves Babylon 5. Like you guys, he loves when they don't shy away from or try to erase religion like other sci-fi, or present it in a negative light. Great podcast episode, as always.
Thank you. Now, we mentioned recently the medical issues that Becky's husband Tim had regarding his kidney. And on a recent episode, they did give an update that they're moving towards being able to do home dialysis, which is a big step in terms of the time away from the house, the time away from his work, because he's actually trying to get back to work. The one thing they did express at this point was that just of uncertainty. Uncertainty of how much he was going to be able to work. And then, as anyone who's gone through a medical thing, it takes a while to get the bills. You just don't know what's going to be covered, what's going to not be covered. So that's their concern now, frankly, is it's not necessarily financial per se, it's the uncertainty of what the financial aspects are, and the home dialysis versus the having to go to the outpatient dialysis, just all of that. It's just a lot of uncertainty. The kind and lovely Sutherlands, who we hung out with for a few hours over the holidays, they also wrote in about Babylon 5. Hi, Em and Professor Allen. As fans of both Dorkness Delight and Babylon 5, this was an extra special episode for us. It was fun to hear the lively conversation you had with Chris Tyler. We agree that it's very interesting to see how religion is portrayed in the universe created by J. Michael Straczynski. It adds a solid foundation and depth to the world, as well as provides an opportunity to strengthen characters and to address issues of faith and morality in stories. This adds to the compelling nature of many of the stories in Babylon 5. We appreciated your comments about the appropriate specific names and identities who were selected for individuals representing a variety of world religions. That was good attention to detail by the writers of the show. I hope you circle back and talk about more episodes of Babylon 5 in the future. And so do we.
Yeah.
We hope that too.
Let me just say, with all the stuff about, like, you know, Aboriginal and Indigenous religion and the way that that exists, we really should do Walkabout. Walkabout.
That's not a bad one.
Tim Price also wrote in with some comments about Babylon 5 and some other stuff. Hello, Profess M.
Okay.
All right. Okay. We'll accept that. He says, you can tell it's a holiday weekend because I had time to listen to the Babylon 5 episode and send feedback on the same day. That never happens.
Boom.
I was fortunate to see B5's one-shot special and the first 4 seasons when they air, But sadly, circumstances made me miss all of season 5, and I still haven't watched it. I still haven't finished it either.
Problem is, you're gonna cry. Sorry. Spoilers, Em and Tim.
He continues, I enjoyed the show quite a bit. It's just a harder one to catch in reruns or streaming. True. And I have been too cheap / lazy to get it on DVD. Support your local library.
That's where we get ours from.
But boy, your coverage is already brewing my interest in a rewatch. We'll have to see if Santa helps me out on that front. This specific episode is so good. I remember it very well. And you two, plus Chris, covered it so well. I can't imagine what I could add. Every part of the show was just excellent, throughout the mystery to the surprise at the end, and your discussion was simply excellent. I will add that being a computer programmer by profession, I really enjoyed the idea of a monk white hat hacker in the future. Would the internet be a better place today if software developers were less hardcore programmers and instead more altruistic developers? An interesting notion, considering how much the internet's influence on daily life has changed in the time since B5 was on air. Now, have I ever shared my sacred origin with you? If I have, pardon me for filling up your inbox again. And if not, let's do this! Honestly, it's not that complicated. My father was a United Methodist minister by the time I was born, and that's the church I grew up with. Sunday school, children's choir, services, potluck dinners. Lots of potluck dinners.
There are Methodists in our family. We understand lots of potluck dinners.
Sadly, my dad passed away when I was 16 from cancer, which disrupted lots of things in my life. My mom moved us from Illinois to Virginia, where her side of the family is, and eventually we joined a Baptist church that her friends from work attended. In college, I backslid on going to church, mostly because I was feeling the freedom to choose for myself, but also because my efforts to get into any church were pretty feeble. Afterwards, that same trend continued until I met my future wife. We started doing a good job of pushing each other to get back to church, and her background was with an Episcopal church. Nice. Once we moved near her hometown, her childhood church has been our church ever since. The main thread for me all along has been choir. I enjoy singing in choirs, and I'll try just about anything. Granted, I haven't closely followed contemporary Christian music, but I usually like what I hear. I guess I'm more of an old-school hymn and classical anthem kind of person. Although the Episcopal Church's Anglican musical tradition is still new to me, so it has some fun challenges. But I just honestly find music to be my favorite way to express and live my faith.
Now, Tim is about to make a reference here to some voiceover work that he has done for a crew of our comic book podcasting buddies.
So I guess it would have made sense that I've grown up to become the voice of Mephisto for the comic book podcast community. I will say there were plenty of Twitter chats happening last year before that crossover where the podcasters would be sending me requests for new Mephisto audio, and I'd glance at the messages while in church on a Sunday morning, sitting in the choir loft, because God has a sense of humor. Again, thank you both for this fun and thought-provoking show. I haven't gone through all the back episodes, but now that Alan has pointed me to the Spectre episode...
See, comic books.
I'm definitely going to give that one a listen. May the Force be with you, Tim Price.
And also with you. Tim had some thoughts on our second presentation of Harry Whodunit. Hi, Middletons. Oh, wow. I was totally sucked into the story and mystery. The writing that went into Harry's stories was really great. Everything linked together nicely and made for a wonderful, kid-friendly mystery to solve. And man, I was shouting at the show when I saw the Giants of Chess Don't Allow Girls part coming. Oh, no, no, no! But that's because I was sucked into the story and delighted by the conclusion. Love, love, love. On a side note, I find some fascinating value in the little bits of your outlook that you've shared, like Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. That struck such a chord with me. Much appreciated. Thank you so much for sharing the Harry tapes. Blessings from your friend Tim.
And on last episode, Christmas Eve and Other Stories, Tim had this to say. Hi, Alan and Em. Those were delightful stories, so grateful that you shared them. I don't have anything to share from my Christmas services, but the big thing was my daughter Jenny recovering from surgery and treating the Lyme disease, and with that, another kind of story comes to mind. While my wife and I sat with Jenny in post-op, one of the nurses came in and announced, "Your pastor is here." Now, this took us by surprise because this was a Thursday and our church had a brand new pastor who had started the previous Sunday. He had barely met us, but my wife had informed the youth director slash education director slash that person who makes sure that the things get done
yes.
about Jenny. And she must have let Father Tuck know. His first name is Tucker, but goes by Tuck. If you are thinking Friar Tuck, you are not alone. He was just as calm and thoughtful as I had seen on his first Sunday and grateful for the prayer he shared before he left. The next day, I was keeping Jenny company before lunchtime, and Father Tuck came for another visit and brought his assistant, a six-month-old King Charles Spaniel puppy named Nellie.
Now that's a solid associate pastor.
That's how you do. That is how you do. Jenny was delighted, more so because she'd been taking small animal care as an elective at school, and she just finished the dog breed section.
See?
So she was in love. Definitely the high point of her day. I hope to get to know Father Tuck better given time, not just as Jenny's dad. I'll be surprised if he has any nerdy interests like your Father Joe, but you never know. And we have at least a shared love of animals. His wife brings Nellie to the Sunday morning services, and the congregation loves her as much as we do, almost to distraction.
Yep.
Happy New Year. Live long and prosper. Tim.
So, Em, he gave a shout-out to Father Joe. Any updates on that and St. Matt's since Christmas Eve, Midnight Mass?
Well, the original plan was that I was going to go occasionally. But now that I've been going regularly, I have become known.
Oh, my lands.
Which means that both Father Joe and the assistant, the gets things
the
done.
The gets things done person?
The gets things done of St. Matt's both know me on site by name.
Uh-oh.
So I was actually recruited to a church plant this
You're
morning.
You're in trouble. So what was that?
So I'm gonna be on a council. For a church planning session. This
awesome.
Is what happens. This is what happens. You find people you care about who are doing things you're interested in, and all of a sudden they're like, "Hey, do you want to do things you're interested in?"
So what you're saying is, all that money we spent to get you a college degree with a minor in religion, finally paying off.
Finally,
boom!
Finally paying off.
Now, this episode will be coming out after Ash Wednesday, but it's currently before Ash Wednesday, and our plan is to go, and what is that scoop?
So, we'd mentioned it briefly, the Ashes to Go is a program that they do at the coffee shop next door to, you know, the pub where they have Sunday services, and we are going to show up there, get some coffee before I have to go to work, get our ashes and get our hugs. Before we have to go and do our things.
And I'll meet Father Joe.
And you'll meet Father Joe.
Perfect.
I don't know. This recording is getting kind of late. I still say you should go to Vespers, but
explain what the Vespers is tonight.
So tonight's Vespers, which maybe you'll actually go to. We'll see. It's Les Mis themed. It's using Victor Hugo as one of their source texts in order to do their evening service. And they actually have an understudy for Jean Valjean who's going to be leading the singing.
That sounds pretty epic.
Gonna be
really
good.
I'm just saying.
It's gonna be really, really, really good. They've been practicing a lot. The choir at St. Matt's is really good. And the choir director and the gentleman who was an understudy and Father Joe have all been working together. And it's gonna be really good.
Thank you for all those emails, Tim. Thank you, Em, for that update. We also heard from Chris Cook from One Cross Radio, who got to us via Redeemed Otaku. He called the Blue Christmas episode simply fantastic. And on last episode, he replied with, "Man, oh man, is this episode terrific and well worth a listen." Now, I don't think they've released their next episode yet, but they did just recently record their 100th episode. So,
congratulations.
Shout out to them.
And on that Christian pop culture episode, we heard from Robert Ludwig. Hi, Professor Allen and M. Due to usually listening in the car, I don't often get to jot down any thoughts on the episodes. However, this episode took longer than my car trip, so I was able to make a few notes before I went to work. While I don't know some of the Christian pop culture shows you referenced, Harry Whodunit as an example, I did want to talk about some that I had thoughts on.
Now, we used to think that nobody knew Harry Whodunit, but based on these episodes, you, me, and two listeners had heard of Harry Whodunit before, so it's almost one handful of people.
That's twice as many people as we thought. Robert says, first, VeggieTales. Before we adopted our son, I really hadn't heard of these singing vegetables. However, after adopting him, I got familiar. And quickly. My personal favorite is the VeggieTales Worship Songs CD. It has some good tunes wrapped around a story of Bob and Larry having to lead the kids due to their director having some kind of appointment. There's some between song skits, and a girl in one of the skits between the first and second songs reminds me of a friend's daughter. Also, whenever we're somewhere and hear a song from this album, my son always says, "It's a VeggieTales song." We've had a lot of fun with the CD and hours of entertainment. He never really got into DVDs or VHS tapes. Yes.
What?
I still have two working VHS players.
You are a hero.
Now that he is 12, he probably never will be.
Yep.
Davy and Goliath. I remember this show from when I was a kid. I don't remember you mentioning it at all. What were your thoughts on it? Did you see it as it was off TV as M was growing up? I do not remember this one at all.
This is very old, like 50s, early 60s, claymation-ish
really?
Type of things.
Oh.
Davy. It's hard to explain.
To YouTube. Number 3, Adventures in Odyssey. I had never heard of this show until I started dating my wife. As a side note, we have been married for 24 plus years. She liked to listen to the Christian music station that played near where she lived. The music was okay, mostly standard Christian rock and pop. But what caught my attention when we were traveling somewhere and this show came on? I think it's kind of like podcasts to me. I can see in my mind how I believe the characters to be. There's usually some mystery or something with a Bible lesson. Was this on any station that you would be listening to? If I'm ever traveling and listening to the radio and happen to catch an episode, I still listen. Anyway, I hope everything finds you and your loved ones well. Take care, Robert.
Adventures in Odyssey.
I watched the animated TV, like VHS versions of that. I knew it was a radio show.
See, I don't remember us listening or watching it, but probably at your Christian daycare or babysitter. That's probably where it would have.
It was big at Grandma and Grandpa's church.
VBS.
And the VBS.
Gotcha.
So when I would do the VBS, Adventures in Odyssey was a big one. I do not have as fond memories of it as I think some other people may. I mean, I know no one's ever heard of it, but Harry Whodunit is better.
So you're bitter that
I'm just
Odyssey
a hipster about
McGee and Me, they took away from potential listeners of Harry.
McGee and Me is like some weird 90s Christian kid fugue state. Like nobody ever remembers McGee and Me, but then you show them the intro and you go, I thought that I dreamed that up on a cold syrup trip one day that I was homesick from school. But no, that one existed. It was just a weird collective consciousness fugue state fever dream that all of us had and actually physically manifested onto VHS. Like, that's all I can imagine.
Well, I do want to give, this is not a reco, because I have mixed feelings about the show, but I will mention a podcast called the Prophetic Imagination Station, which is a combination of the book Prophetic Imagination and the Christian show Imagination Station.
Oh my gosh.
Smushed together. And what they have done is have gone over a dozen or so episodes of Odyssey and some of McGee and Me. And in their current season, they're looking at Frank Peretti's novel, This Present Darkness. The hosts are a married couple who were raised evangelical and have become more progressive in their faith, but still have coming at it from a Christian faith aspect. But the problem is, say, Adventures in Odyssey.
it has a viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
These two hosts have a viewpoint. Every episode, they have the same conflict. You know,
right.
Every episode, it's, this is white evangelical American 90s evangelicalism. It's imperialistic. It's this, it's that. It's
which is true.
There's truth to that. But the show does get a bit repetitive. The podcast does get a bit repetitive. So it is, they have the same issues with different episodes over and over. I'm actually looking forward to the Frank Peretti, which is sort of a spiritual warfare novel. And I think they're planning to do some interviews with people and talk about the effect of it. So they've sort of laid out their thesis for that season of the show, which is that sort of in an underground way, this is one of the most significant pieces of Christian literature in the last 30 or 40 years. And,
yeah,
and it is
definitely.
It has shaped a lot of evangelicalism, but in sort of a hidden, almost underground way.
Not to bring the Babylon Bee back into this, but honestly, that thing about 90% of Christian theology is based on supernatural, 90% of supernatural is based on this present darkness. Like, that's not a stretch.
So they're going to be talking about demons and angels and spiritual warfare and basically small town 90s Christian America and their fears.
Yeah.
So that one, I think, at least...
it's got some
social implications. I have higher hopes that it'll be more interesting than the sort of the somewhat more repetitive episodes. But I like the concept, and I think if you know people sort of like what we're doing and are a little more on the moderate to progressive side, they might enjoy the Prophetic Imagination Station.
Specifically podcast. Season 3.
Specifically, yes. Yes. And we do have some sad news to share here at the end of the episode. For the last number of years, really, we've chronicled the health situation of Dr. Heather Ludwig, the wife of faithful listener and feedbacker Robert Ludwig. And sadly, recently, she lost her years-long battle with cancer. On February 7th, he posted this, "I hate cancer. Today it took the love of my life away. While I know she's in heaven watching over my son and I, she is being missed and will continue to be missed for a long time. I love you, Heather." And then just a few days ago, "And today we said our final goodbye to her physical body. The pain of losing her is still fresh, but I do thank God for having put Heather in my life. And while there have been tears, she had a loving celebration of life today as she wanted. I love you, Heather." And I reached out to Robert, and he sent her obituary and got a little bit of information from that. And we'll say that Heather was baptized and raised in the Lutheran Church, and as an adult was an active member of the Nevada, Iowa First United Methodist Church. She married Robert in 1995, began her career as a high school teacher in 1998, and earned a doctorate in education from Drake University. As an infant, Heather herself was adopted. As Robert mentioned in his email, in 2008, they adopted their son, Peter. Heather Ludwig was 47.
And to all of our listeners, most especially Robert, let us say, may the force be with you.
And also with you. While you're waiting for the next podcast episode, check out our websites. DorknessToLight.blogspot.com contains reviews, essays, and other similar ramblings.
And DorknessToLight.tumblr.com, which contains some of that material, as well as top tens, cool photographs, memes, and religious puns. We also run a general interest comic book podcast network, Relatively Geeky. That content can be found at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or by searching iTunes for Relatively Geeky.
Let us know what you think of this topic, this episode, or this podcast in general. Feel free to send your thoughts to us at dorknesstolight@gmail.com. We would also appreciate any ratings or reviews left for the podcast in the iTunes store to help like-minded people find us.
Our intro, outro, and promo music is all provided by Anderson Kale. Search for them online to listen to or purchase their music.
Thanks for listening.